Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me today, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
Wayne Moyer with us, joining us by phone from Grinnell. He's a Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Wayne, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben.
I want to welcome our listeners as well. Of course, a heavy focus on foreign policy, international politics today. You know, Jim and Wayne are our guys when it comes to international politics. If you have questions, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. A lot of area to cover, a lot of it revolving around this past weekend's G7 summit, Iran, climate change, China, trade, Russia. Let's work through some of those, gentlemen, and get your thoughts on that. If we could, let's start off with Iran. Our president saying he would be open to a meeting with President Hassan Rouhani of Iran, would even be willing to support short-term loans to get Tehran through its current financial difficulties if talks open. Now, the president was responding to an overture by the French president, Emmanuel Macron, who said he would try to set up such a meeting in the next few weeks. Let's listen to Macron. In a press conference yesterday, Macron expressed his expectations for Iran when it comes to nuclear weapons and said preparations are underway for a meeting between the Iranian president and President Trump. Here's Macron with translations, a translation from the Irish media network RTE.
We need to be sure that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon and that there will be no flare-ups in the region. And so what we discussed very concretely was to see how we could improve very considerably, or really, in fact, build a new nuclear agreement with Iran.
Okay, so this is interesting. Wayne, let me go to you, because the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, arrived at the G7 at a sort of a surprise invitation of the French president, right, Wayne?
Yes, he certainly did. I think what the French are trying to do is to preserve the nuclear agreement with Iran, which the U.S., of course, pulled out of. And the hope is, and I think similar to the situation in North Korea, is to tempt Trump to have a meeting with with the Iranian leader, because Trump gets a lot of publicity out of these meetings. The question is whether the Iranians will possibly agree to it till the U.S. Stops the sanctions, which are it's already placed on Iran. And my sense is at the moment they haven't agreed to do that.
I think, isn't it?
Or haven't agreed to meet before sanctions are removed.
Right. That's the important point. Jim, weigh in here, because the Iranians said no deal even to talks until we get rid of these hefty sanctions.
Right. I think that's the key point. And I would be surprised if the Trump administration would yield at all on those sanctions, because they not only have those sanctions on Iran, of course, but they're also in the process of having what are called secondary sanctions against some of the European states that continue to trade with Iran and to put pressure on those companies. So, I mean, one of the moves they might make, rather than lifting the sanctions wholly on Iran, would be to maybe pull back a bit on some of those secondary sanctions. And that might be enough of an incentive for the Iranians to meet. But I think the other thing that has to come also is that the Iranians would have to agree that they'll just not talk about nuclear weapons, but they will also talk about, in any kind of meeting, they will talk about missile testing, and that they will also talk about their support for groups in the Middle East. So I think it's much more complex, at least from the American point of view, than just lifting sanctions or even the primary sanctions, but maybe those secondary sanctions, and also the kind of statement from the Iranian president to talk about these other issues that have been also really part of the debate here.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, what do you think about that? Because this has been Donald Trump's big thing here, too, is that the Iranians have been destabilizing many parts of the Middle East, and to get them to back off on those efforts.
I think it's very difficult to do in Iran because the Iranian leadership itself, so far as we can tell, is very divided. And in terms of will they be able to respond, certainly the U.S. sanctions are hurting them badly, so they have some incentives to make some concessions. On the other hand, I think Trump will have some difficulty giving up too much because he's so closely linked to President Netanyahu in Israel, who's got an election coming up, and a harsh policy toward Iran is really central to Prime Minister Netanyahu's political future.
Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Let's move on to another topic of the G7, even though China is not in the G7. Donald Trump pivoting again on China this past weekend. On Monday, President Trump calling Xi Jinping of China, quote, a great leader. That was just a few days, 3 days after branding him as, quote, an enemy of the United States. Donald Trump said Chinese officials had reached out to him by telephone, that the two sides would soon restart trade talks. I guess China did not confirm this. This comes after the latest escalation in tariffs and the president's tweet ordering, his word, ordering American companies to look for ways to pull out of China. Jim, what do you make of where we are in this escalating trade war and the president's tactics?
Well, it's really very confusing with all the differing pieces of information that have come out over the past really 4 or 5 days here. I think part of it is, and one of the things that struck me is, it seems to me that China-U.S. trade sort of really enveloped the whole G7, even though, you know, the French president wanted to have a different kind of focus. It seems to me that that discussion really covered the whole sort of waterfront there. I think part of it on the part of China responding, you know, they announced they were going to put on $75 billion worth of sanctions over several months beginning September 1, and, you know, the president retaliated by saying he was going to up the ante on the tariffs that are going into effect on September 1 and then really add some others on another $300 billion, actually, on October 15th. So I think part of it is really what I read is that the Chinese maybe want to, by having this kind of, at least if it was directly to a phone call or through intermediaries, I think they want to see if, in fact, the Trump administration will soften the imposition of some of those sanctions, because we've seen that before when the president met with President Xi Jinping of China. You know, one of the things that came out of it was to delay the imposition of sanctions. So I think part of this is a little bit of a game here in terms of whether these sanctions will really be put into effect, or the raising of the sanctions, I guess I should say, will really be put in by the Americans here. I'm very, very skeptical that this is going to lead to a negotiated agreement before this election, because I think the Chinese can read the public opinion polls in the U.S. And my view is that they're sort of waiting out. And so this is part of this kind of maneuvering, maybe not to have the imposition. Because again, like Iran, the sanctions that the United States imposed there has hurt. The sanctions that have been imposed, or the tariffs, I should say, that have been imposed on China, and I guess they are in some way sanctions, have also had a debilitating effect on the Chinese economy.
Right. And then we had this curious statement. Let's go back to Friday. Wayne, comment on this. The Federal Reserve Chair Powell said on Friday that the Fed could push through some interest rate cuts, some sort of cut to if the economy weakens because of the trade war. He suggested that the central bank's ability to limit economic damage, there was a limit to it. The president tweeting in response to that is, my only question is, who is our bigger enemy, Jay Powell or Chairman Xi? Comment on that, Wayne.
Well, I think the big thing, at least in terms of what the president said, is if things go bad, he wants somebody to blame it on. And the Federal Reserve is a good place to place the blame. The thing I would want to add to this is that the vacillation in Trump's position leads to uncertainty in the market, which itself, in the long run, is likely to make it much more difficult to deal with China, and it's also may very well limit our U.S. economic growth.
It's interesting. NPR bringing out some important facts. I'll just share with you this week, because this U.S. versus China thing is often framed in terms of jobs being outsourced, American jobs being outsourced, all the cheap labor that we have in China, which, yes, does happen. But NPR reporting this week these facts to show how intertwined the U.S. and the China economies are. How about this? KFC now sells more chicken in China than in the United States. Or, together with its partners, General Motors sold 3.6 million vehicles in China last year, more than in the United States. Jim McCormick, we are intertwined. It's the omelet that you can't unmix, isn't it?
It really is. That's a very nice metaphor there. I mean, we really are so tied together that, You know, they used to say that, you know, when the United States sneezed, the Europeans got a cold. I mean, I suppose the same kind of statement could be made with regard to China. If there's a problem within the U.S., it's going to really affect China and vice versa. And, you know, there obviously has been this decline in growth in China to something like 6.6% here. So we are so very, very much intertwined. I would just add that, you know, Ford Motor Company's and its health and its maybe survival really depends upon that that Chinese market. You talk about General Motors, but Ford Motor Company, the other sort of big automaker in the U.S., is also very dependent on that Chinese market here. So, you know, the efforts to try to gain advantage, which is part of the sort of the Trump transactional approach to foreign policy, is really negated by these close connections here.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, the Politics Wednesday edition of our program. This first half hour, spending it with politics abroad, or as in terms of foreign policy for the United States, revolving around the G7 on Monday. Let's talk about this briefly. The president said he would invite President Vladimir Putin to next year's summit. We remember that Russia was expelled from the G8 in 2014 because of its annexation of Crimea from Ukraine, a violation clearly of international laws and agreements. Let's listen to the president. I would like to get both of your reaction to this, your reactions, because the president on Monday in a news conference, here he is characterizing the reason Russia is no longer in the G7 and why sanctions were imposed on Russia for annexing part of Ukraine.
It was sort of taken away from President Obama. Not taken away from President Trump, taken away from President Obama. President Obama was not happy that this happened because it was embarrassing to him, right? It was very embarrassing to him. And he wanted Russia to be out of what was called the G8. And that was his determination. He was outsmarted by Putin. He was outsmarted. President Putin outsmarted President Obama. Wait a minute. And I can understand how President Obama would feel. He wasn't happy. And they're not in for that reason. Now, I'm only thinking about the world, and I'm thinking about this country in terms of the G7, whether it's G7, G8. I think it would be better to have Russia inside the tent than outside the tent.
Okay, what do you think about that, Wayne? Russia pushed out of the G8 because its annexation of Crimea was embarrassing to Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, and that Obama was outsmarted?
I would look at the issue entirely differently. Borders in Europe, because they have been violated so many times historically, have a certain sacredness to them. And when Putin went into Crimea, that put shocks of alarm with all sorts of other European leaders worried about their boundaries and with their past experience in being invaded by Germany or being taken over by the Soviet Union. And I think it would be very difficult for European leaders to sort of forgive Putin for taking over the Crimea.
Mm-hmm. And of course, when we look to next year, the U.S. is the host next year. Another issue is the president wanting, suggesting that they hold it at his Miami resort. But I guess, Jim, one of the ideas is it doesn't take a leap to see that the president, our president, could invite Putin to next year's G7.
He could do that, but I really do think it would be a considerable mistake. The G7 is likely to happen right before the election, for one thing, and I'm not sure that he would want that kind of controversy. And I frankly am really puzzled by this, because I don't know why you would reward Putin by inviting him back into the G7, not only because of the efforts that he's made with regard to Crimea and the Ukraine, but some of the other actions that you hear about, including this, even denying these visits by U.S. senators here to Russia. So I'm very puzzled by what could possibly be gained, because if in fact Putin was invited, he would become the center of attention, it seems to me, at that G7/G8 meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And that would overshadow any kind of effort that the other members might make on some of the global issues here. And actually, the G7 or G8 is supposed to be the industrial democracies of the world that are supposed to get together to try to manage global economic and increasingly political problems. And, there's been obviously backsliding with regard to Russia, and maybe other states too, but certainly with regard to Russia.
At one time, it did qualify,
and then it
became increasingly autocratic.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You talk about what this group gets together for, the reason it is, and one of the big reasons was really sidelined by all the issues we've been talking about. The Group of Seven agreed to, a $20 million aid package to help Brazil and its neighbors fight these fires raging in the Amazon forest. There was a session at the G7 on climate, the oceans, biodiversity, including the representatives of several countries that were not even in the Group of Seven. Notably, our president did not attend that session, Wayne Moyer. So this is a huge concern of the rest of the G7, not especially of this president, evidently.
Well, I think this all gets to Trump's overall policies of being very skeptical of the whole climate change issue, and making the argument that if we do anything to deal with the climate, it's probably going to cost American jobs. I'm not at all sure that that's accurate, but it would lead to a slowing of the economy and perhaps would relate to some of his core constituency, where he's promised that the economy would thrive and it would provide more jobs, and dealing with climate change would take away from economic prosperity. I think this is very questionable, but I have a feeling that's partly behind what the president is doing.
Mm-hmm. In the three or four minutes we have before we take a break, let me depart from the G7 to go to another international issue that I love to talk about with you two, with your expertise. On Saturday, North Korea launched two short-range ballistic missiles 2 days after South Korea decided to pull out of a military intelligence sharing agreement with Japan. So these are two of our big allies in Southeast Asia, Japan and South Korea. This was North Korea's seventh weapons test in a month. I don't know who would like to jump in here to explain the disagreement between South Korea and Japan and how it concerns the U.S. Is this something you can talk to, Jim?
Well, there's been this long kind of tension between Japan and Korea of the history of it with regard to, obviously Japan controlling Korea for the longest time, as a result of actually going back even before World War II. But I think this kind of tension here you know, continues to be sort of underlying in terms of the relationship. I'm not sure about the immediate, you know, sort of spark that moved them not to have any intelligence sharing, but maybe there's been some concern on either one of the members here about some of the intelligence that may have leaked out or something like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe Wayne has a view on that, too.
What strikes me about this is the North Korea's testing of short-range missiles is a huge threat to Japan. And because Japan is close, it's not much of a threat to the United States. And in nurturing the U.S.-Japanese alliance, which is very critical, I think, to the United States, I think we should be reacting more strongly to North Korea's missile launches. And the U.S. also needs to get directly involved to try to ameliorate the relationship between Japan and South Korea and see what it can do to ease tensions between those two countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially with North Korea. We need those key allies in this area. The president's reaction, interesting comment on this. He says about these tests, I said, you know, 7 weapons tests in a month. He says the tests did nothing to complicate his relationship with North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, or his hopes for denuclearization talks. Quote from the president, "He likes testing missiles, but we never restricted short-range missiles. Many nations test those missiles." Jim, so are you at all surprised that the president is not, you know, being more alarmed, at least outwardly more alarmed, that the North Korean president is obviously sending these missiles off as a message, right?
Absolutely, that he's still in the game with regard to, you know, using the capability that he has. And I am surprised, you know, if we put it in the context of this South Korean issue here as well, and sort of to reinforce what Wayne said, I mean, why should the Trump administration not be concerned? Because the short-range missiles are the ones that could be obviously the most damaging to South Korea or even to Japan here in terms of across the Sea of Japan, which
right.
is a relatively short distance here. So it is really striking that the president wants to seemingly isolate his discussions over intercontinental ballistic missiles discussions with Kim Jong-un and what it might mean for some of our two principal allies
right.
in Northeast Asia.
Right. Imagine that. If it was here, it would be similar to lobbing missiles next to Florida or something like that in the Caribbean.
Absolutely. Think of Cuba a few decades ago.
Okay. I'll try not to. Jim McCormick with us, professor of political science at Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. When we come back, Frank Phillips will join us as well from the Boston Globe with a home state view of presidential candidate Bill Weld, a Republican challenging Donald Trump. Ben Kiefer back in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, our political scientists here, picking through, offering their thoughts on many of the especially international aspects of our politics in the recent days. I'm going to ask Jim and Wayne to sit on the sidelines just for a moment because we want to have more analysis from them in just a moment after we continue our 2020 caucus series, Home State View, where we learn about the 2020 candidates by talking with news media figures who have covered them for some time in their home states. Today, a home state view of former Massachusetts governor and 2020 Republican presidential candidate Bill Weld. Weld is one of 2 officially challenging Donald Trump for the Republican presidential nomination. Joining us, Frank Phillips of the Boston Globe, political correspondent, former State House bureau chief. Frank Phillips, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Ben.
And just to give our audience an idea, you've been covering Bill Weld, politics there in that area for quite some time.
you're making me an old man, yes. Bill Weld ran for attorney general in 1978 and got clobbered, but I was there scribbling down his good words.
He's now a former two-term governor of Massachusetts, first Republican to be elected governor in Massachusetts in 20 years when he was elected in 1990. What can you tell us about how Bill Weld rose to public life, rose to the office of governor?
He really made his name. He ran for attorney general, as I said. He was just a lawyer, and he got clobbered. He just he won one town in their whole state. So but out of that, he got involved in politics. And under Reagan, he was appointed U.S. attorney in Boston, and he really made a name for himself. He went after our Boston mayor, Kevin White, and came damn near to indicting him. And then he went on to the Reagan Attorney General's office in Washington. And he came back and he put on a very spirited fight in the Republican primary. At first it looked like he would be a big loser, and he pulled it out at the end in a very dramatic way, and then went into got the Republican nomination and took on a very controversial figure, John Silber, the president of Boston University, who had won on a sort of a Trump-like ticket, took over the Democratic Party nomination, and Weld eked out a very close victory. It was quite a dramatic race.
Mm-hmm. When those in Massachusetts know Bill Weld for what kind of positions? I understand fiscally conservative, but quite progressive on social issues, right?
He is. He's he took no new tax pledges and was very hard on spending, and he was always he vetoed a lot of stuff out of the budget, the Democratic legislature overran him. But he, on the social issues, he was way out there on gay rights, as we used to call it back in those days in the 90s. He called himself green as a grape on the environment, and he did a lot for the environment around here. He had a very progressive views. He also had some very conservative views too. He was tough on crime. He had a great phrase in his 1990 race. He was going to reintroduce them to the joys of busting rocks, referring to the people, inmates. He was pro death penalty, tough on crime, and helped put through a very tough crime bill. So he's on both sides of the ledger, and it was always very interesting to talk to liberal Democrats, some of whom I know would vote for him because of his very progressive stance on other issues.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about Bill Weld personally and the people he surrounds himself with.
They're very loyal. I mean, Bill Weld's he's a very nice guy. He's a very affable, funny. He loves the. When he was at Harvard, he was at that famous club called the Hasty Pudding Club, and they put on all kinds of shows. And he loves to get up. And I always would say this is an extension of his Hasty Pudding career here. And he would get up at St. Patrick's Day breakfasts and sing with the Irish Pals of Boston, and they loved him for it. He was very popular with Democrats, mm-hmm. and he was very popular with his staff. There was a very loyal group of people around him, and he was a very popular governor.
How does he deal with criticism when he gets criticism? How does he take it?
He takes it with a good broad smile. I've come to him with all kinds of things. And he would just burst out laughing and then give a good quote for it. He was old moneyed Yankee, as we say here. You know, this was just a big game for him. He didn't have any personal stake in it, other than he did want to go on to be a U.S. senator. And as popular as he was, and he took on John Kerry in 1996, and he actually was more popular than Kerry, but the Massachusetts sent back Kerry to the Senate, and Weld lost, and it was a big defeat for him. He really thought that was a stepping stone to the national stage.
Mm-hmm. He was on Morning Edition this morning. Bill Weld, an interview with him, and it seems by that interview, I don't know if you heard it there, Frank.
No,
but,
I didn't. No.
But it seems he's counting on the New Hampshire primary to kind of shake things up. and put him in the running for real, not just as a sort of a long shot.
Well, that's his only shot, as I see it, and I've told his supporters, and I told him when that he told his people that he should have, and he hasn't done it yet. He should go up and rent a house in Concord, New Hampshire, with his wife, and just stay up there and not leave, and get those independent. There's a strong moderate Republican faction in the Republican Party up there, and he just needs to get 35% of the vote. That would be an incredible blow to Trump. And he could put together that coalition, I believe, if he go out there and work it, and work it very hard. He's having trouble raising money. He doesn't have much of a staff. He can't pay people a lot of money. So I don't know what is really going on with him in terms of what the future is in New Hampshire. Remember, Gene McCarthy only got, less than 40% of the vote in New Hampshire, but it was a big blow to Lyndon Johnson in 1968. And that's the kind of thing that Weld could deliver to Trump here, could shake him up.
Mm-hmm. Frank, in the final minute, can you tell us something about Bill Weld that hasn't been widely reported, or through your decades of covering him, a fun fact about what he's done or his background?
Well, he's, I suppose, probably one thing, it won't ever come out, it could come out if he be the nominee. He's a novelist. He wrote his first novel when he was the governor of the Commonwealth here. And it was called Mackerel by Moonlight. It wasn't bad. It didn't make the bestsellers list, but he's written about, I think, three novels, and I don't see it on his resume, but he's a very clever person. He's very smart. He went through Harvard very easily, and he's an interesting character. I don't know how he's going to rub with the Republican Party out there in Iowa, but he was very popular here in Massachusetts.
Okay, I guess we'll see. Thank you very much, Frank Phillips of the Boston Globe, giving us a home state view of former Massachusetts governor and current 2020 Republican presidential candidate Bill Weld. Thank you, Frank, for these insights. It was fascinating.
Well, thank you, Ben. Anytime. Give me a call.
All right, will do. Back to Wayne Moyer and Jim McCormick, our political scientists on this Politics Wednesday. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, where he's Rosenfield Professor of Political Science. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Let's pick up with the 2020 race, gentlemen, there where we left off, because we've heard now, just this week, the former one-term congressman from Illinois turned conservative radio talk show host, Joe Walsh, announcing his 2020 challenge for the Republican nomination on Sunday. Here he is highlighting himself as a conservative alternative to President Trump.
Let's be real. These are scary times. So the hell with all those conventional things. Today I'm declaring my candidacy for President of the United States because it's time to be brave. We have someone in the White House who we all know is unfit. Someone who lies virtually every time he opens his mouth, and someone who places his own interests above the nation's interest at every single turn. We cannot afford four more years of Donald Trump. No way.
Joe Walsh announcing his 2020 challenge for the Republican nomination on Sunday. Evidently, the president taking some notice of this small field of fellow Republicans challenging or contemplating challenging him for the 2020 nomination. In a pair of tweets yesterday, the president referred to having three stooges running against me. Mark Sanford, I guess, thrown in there too as one of the contemplators. Wayne Moyer, contemplate Donald Trump not winning the nomination. Can you?
It's difficult at the moment, just given the stability of his base and the stability of his support in terms of public opinion. But if the economy turns down and if the trade war with China continues, there's a possibility, perhaps in New Hampshire. Remember, it was as the Vietnam War went bad that Eugene McCarthy was able to challenge President Lyndon Johnson. So I wouldn't rule it out, but it's a long haul.
Others speculated as challenging Donald Trump. We Mark Sanford there, evidently on the president's radar, but also Jeff Flake, the former Arizona senator. Jim McCormick, what do you make of these challenges to Donald Trump, who has very, very strong approval ratings from his base, right?
Yes, he does. And I mean, he also has, you know, Republican political leadership, you know, really frightened to kind of move away from him in any way here. I think part of this is, you know, Jeff Flake, I suppose, might be in terms of down the road thinking about some other kind of political ambitions that he might have. I was struck by the point about New Hampshire and if he could do some damage in New Hampshire, given that, you know, I suppose that is a possibility. And the Eugene McCarthy example is a good one because, you know, a lot of people came out and thought McCarthy won that primary. Actually, he didn't win the primary, but he was portrayed as having won it. And so, you know, beyond expectations, if he were to do well beyond expectations, Bill Weld might be able to move on, you know, on to South Carolina or somewhere else. But I think, you know, as Wayne said, it's really a long shot. It's really hard to sort of anticipate that anybody would really be successful. I think many of these candidates have their egos involved in.
You think that was my next question,
yeah,
Jim?
And just initiating these things.
Yeah. Why do it if you have such a long shot?
Yeah, I think it. You know, I mean, Wells' career. I mean, I can't envision him taking on some new office or seeking some new office. So I think it's more, you know, the idea of. At least that I would interpret it, that you know, it's sort of some self-fulfillment for him, I guess, in some sense. In terms of Walsh and Sanford, you know, they again, I think it's mainly, you know, their individual kind of concerns here rather than anything else.
Or that off chance that if somehow Donald Trump falls out of favor very quickly, they are there to fill the void, they think.
Yeah, but I think... Possibly, but I think somebody else more prominent in the Republican Party would probably step in. That would be my take.
Interesting. Let's turn our focus to the Democrats in the remaining minutes here. I see NPR reporting how Senator Elizabeth Warren, I think they say, surging in the polls and in fundraising. Let's go back to where she was in April, not polling that well, around 6% in fifth place. Then she had those two solid debate performances. As a result, bringing in $25 million, more than doubling her support, polling consistently second or third nationally, moving up there, even has the attention of Donald Trump, who has complained about the media coverage of her crowd size. Listen to this verbatim Donald Trump tweet. They do stories so big about Elizabeth, Pocahontas, Warren's crowd sizes, adding many more people than are actually there. And yet my crowds, which are far bigger, get no coverage at all. Fake news, unquote, Donald Trump tweet there. Wayne Moyer, Iowa poll showing her now in second place in Iowa behind the former Vice President Biden, third in New Hampshire. Thoughts on her rise and her candidacy, Wayne?
Well, I think part of it is that she has a lot of policy proposals which people can relate to. Part of it is after she gives her talks, she stays around and has people take selfies with her. So the sort of ability to sort of commune, if you would, with the audience, I think has been very helpful. She's smart. She's got policy ideas. She can relate to common people. Her own experience and suffering in her own family and all of that, I think allows her to empathize with her audience, or at least her audience to feel that she will represent them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you remind me in your comment, Wayne, of Bill Clinton. After watching him at an arena here in Iowa give an hour and a half speech, he then, I watched with amazement as he went down and he just mingled and talked and talked and talked with whoever was there. There was a large crowd there to see him. Jim McCormick, your thoughts on Elizabeth Warren?
Yeah, I think I just would add that she's incredibly articulate in those debates and very quick on her feet in terms of responding to some of the other candidates. And I think that is really going to be the thing to watch in this upcoming debate. To what extent she continues to take on Bernie Sanders or to stay close to him on some of her proposals, and to what extent that, you know, she takes on Biden. And, you know, sort of, I think the real question is Biden going to be able to sort of stand toe-to-toe with her in terms of the kind of presentation? Because not only does she have this ability in terms of the policy issues and meeting her constituents or potential constituents, but she's very, very articulate and very quick to join in the debate.
Mm-hmm. What separates her? I mean, they both put in the progressive category of the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. What do you see as separating them, Wayne?
Well, Bernie's already had his chance, I guess you could say. Bernie is more clearly labeled, I think, falsely as a socialist and have that term hung around his neck. I think her policy proposals are more detailed, that one can see more clearly how things will actually play out than would be the case with some of Bernie's proposals.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, how do you answer that question?
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think also just the, if they will, the presence that Warren has most recently, you know, contrasts with while he has this, while Bernie Sanders has his arms flailing almost at every response that he gives, I think that the kind of passionate response that Warren gives, but also the more sort of disciplined response, is an attractive point.
Tomorrow on the program, I want to mention that we'll be talking about, we're talking with Karen Kedrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics there at ISU, where you are, Jim. But gender has been a big talking point of analysis in recent election campaigns, most notably in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. In closing here, give me your reflections. How much you think gender is playing a part in this campaign season, or have we reached a post-gender campaign society? Wayne Moyer.
I'm not sure, but I think that Warren coming on strong at this stage of the game is a positive sign that we're moving in the right direction mm-hmm. in terms of more gender equality.
Yeah. Jim McCormick, do you see these candidates portrayed by the media or evaluated in another way in terms of gender?
No, I think Wayne's right. We're really moving in that direction. And in fact, you know, some of the latest polling data, Quinnipiac has a poll out even today that shows, you know, that women's support for some of the Democratic candidates is very high, and Trump has a real problem there in terms of gaining support. So I think that is also indicative of the kind of changes that we're witnessing.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left. What are you watching in terms of the winnowing field of Democratic candidates, Jim?
Well, I'm not sure how some of these, I mean, maybe Tom Steyer with all his money can stay in the race, but I think some of these others, Tulsi Gabbard, you know, is not qualified. Kirsten Gillibrand might stay in because she apparently is still using some of her Senate campaign money, but I don't know where Bill de Blasio goes or Tim Ryan. I think they probably exit stage left.
Okay. Wayne Moyer, your predictions for how this field gets smaller?
Well, I very much agree with Jim, but I think one problem with people dropping out, some of those who don't make it for the September debate because they have more time will make it for the October debate, and that may keep some of them in a little bit longer than they otherwise would be.
Mm-hmm. And specifically here in Iowa, who do you see doing well, Jim, at this point?
Well, I think you have to stay with Biden is really still informed to lead the field here, but obviously Warren is coming on strong. So I would see that's sort of the debate here. I think Sanders is fading a bit, but we may, you know, maybe he is over the next several weeks. Maybe he can prop up his campaign a bit.
Okay, thank you very much. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer Rosenfield, Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Jim and Wayne, always a pleasure to have you on the program with your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
It's been very nice. Thanks.
Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about Iowa's congressional races with two people who busy themselves in politics. Of course, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, but also James Lynch of the Gazette. We'll talk about the races that include incumbents Joni Ernst, Cindy Axne, Abby Finkenauer, Steve King. But also, we'll see the presidential campaign through a gender lens, or that's what I think. Karen Kedrowski of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University will be my guest for part of the program tomorrow to talk especially about the female candidates for president this time around. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Hope to hear from you tomorrow.